And the second case and last case of the term is United States v. Hippolyte. This has a messy procedural history, and it's a certified case, which normally the government goes first. However, there are cross-appeals and cross-cross-appeals, and the upshot of the whole thing is that Mr. Cassara will go first and the government will go second. Both sides prepared to argue? Mr. Cassara.
Good morning, members of the court. I'm William Cassara, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Ortiz, we represent the appellant in this case. Going off script for just a second, I realized from talking to Mr. Perlack the last time I was here that today is my 30th argument, and apparently with 30 arguments you get free pizza, so it's a good deal. Your Honors, this case, while it has a very complicated history, is in some ways not all that complicated. The military judge erred when he allowed the government to do an end run around this court's decisions in U.S. v. Hills and U.S. v. Hook Hills and admit evidence of specifications 1 and 3 as a common plan or scheme for specifications 4 and 5 and vice versa. Such error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. As the Chief Judge already said, we are dealing with a granted issue and a certified issue. Very quickly, quick rundown of the facts. Sexual assault of R.W., this is when the unit was TDY in Idaho, and as you know, the appellant was acquitted of the sexual assault, abusive sexual contact of R.W. Abusive sexual contact of Sergeant S.A.K., another one of the appellant's friends, came home from a night of drinking. An alleged sexual assault takes place. I take that back. The first specification was that the Air Force Court overturned for factual sufficiency. The appellant was acquitted of specification 2. As I will show you later on in my argument, the acquittal on that charge and the dismissal of the other charge by the Air Force Court does not affect this court's underlying decision in the appellant's opinion. And then the sexual contact of STK, Mr. STK, is the lone surviving specification of the first three. In specifications 4 and 5 of the charge, abusive sexual contact and sexual assault of Senior Airman J.D., in appellant's opinion, a very different factual scenario. So, long story short, there was a combined defense motion to sever specs 1 to 3 from specifications 4 and 5 that resulted in a ruling on 404B. The military judge applied U.S. v. Reynolds and found that all three prongs are satisfied. Regarding the second prong of whether the evidence makes a fact of consequence more or less probable, the military judge concluded that the evidence could be used as a scheme or as evidence of a common plan. In the appellant's position, commonality, as argued by the trial counsel in their closing argument, and evidence of a common plan are simply synonyms for the word propensity. Henceforth, why the appellant believes that this case falls squarely within the realm of U.S. v. Hills and U.S. v. Hook Hills, and why while the Air Force Court analyzed this case for prejudice under U.S. v. Haro and determined that the error was harmless because it did not have a substantial influence on the findings or materially prejudice the appellant's rights to a fair trial, the appellant believes that the proper standard of review in this case is the constitutional standard as used in Hills and Hook Hills, which is whether or not the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Dealing very briefly, unless the court has further questions on it, with the search.
I have one oddball question.
Chief Judge, it wouldn't be an argument if I didn't get one oddball question from someone.
Is there a difference between a plan and a scheme?
Not in my opinion, Judge. No.
That's kind of what I thought, but they seem to toss it about as though they're not quite interchangeable.
And I think part of the issue in this case, Judge, is that we have always used certain terms as it relates to 404B that are not codified in 404B. 404B is really fairly straightforward on its face. But as the case law and as trials have developed, a lot of terms get used in it, and one of those is common plan or scheme, and
it's
two sides of the same coin.
Judge Olson.
Mr. Cassara, yes, as you noted, it was introduced in regard to a common plan or scheme. The government now argues that, in fact, it was used to demonstrate intent. What is your response to that?
I don't think that it changes the underlying argument of whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, but I do believe that the case law states that the government is, for lack of a better term, should be does not get to change arguments midstream, and that we are here to discuss the common plan or scheme. Yes, Judge.
404B has been around for a very long time, you'd agree, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And do you have any case law suggesting that we test 404B for harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, there is none. And I think that's really the issue in this case, is that they use the term, at least we haven't found any, they use the term 404B as a subterfuge for what is really 413 evidence. And when you are using it towards charged offenses in the same case, and Judge, I think...
But isn't that how 404B evidence is used in every case?
And I think that the important thing in this
that
case...
That this involves sex?
I'm sorry.
Is that this that it's used in this case and it involves sex, and so you can shoehorn it into 413 or so?
No, because the question isn't whether or not the 404B evidence was going to be admitted. The evidence was going to be admitted. The accused was charged with those offenses. The question is the use of the 404B evidence. And in this case, what they did was simply an end run around Hills and Who Kills, and because they're using 404B evidence for charged offenses to lower the burden of proof of those charged offenses for the, and I'm using my two hands because there's three specs over here and two over here. That's how I practiced it, so it's worked better for me.
But this goes back to my question, right, which isn't that how 404B evidence is always used?
Not as it relates to offenses charged within the same case. And I believe that since the announcement of Hills and Who Kills, the underlying constitutional problem raised by using 404B evidence on charged offenses is the same as it would be under 413, which is that you have put these dual burdens of proof at play, whereas and I think in this case it's a perfect example of it, where the military judge acquitted him of one specification, but could very well have found by a preponderance of the evidence standard that he had committed that offense and that he would use that offense as proof of the other two offenses, which is constitutionally impermissible.
Mr. Cacera, is your position that it sounds like you might have both of these positions, but is your position number one that all 404B consideration or evidence admitted in a case like this where it's charged conduct is by definition propensity evidence because you can't get around, or number two, if 404B is found to have been improperly admitted, then it becomes propensity evidence and suffers all of the infirmities that we identified in Huckel and Hills. You see what I mean?
I do, Judge. I understand completely. And I think my answer is C, both of the above or none of the above. Mm-hmm. And I say that because the issue in this case is that because the 404B evidence lowered the burden of proof on the first three specifications, its use in this case was impermissible. Judge, I never like to say that there is never a case out there.
I understand.
The opposite could be true. Mm-hmm. But I would certainly think, as a general rule, the use of 404B evidence to lower the burden of proof and to prove charged offenses would be impermissible post-Hills and Who Kills.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
I want to get to the issue of prejudice, but in doing that, I'm trying to think first about the issue of relevance. And assuming that this did show a common scheme and that the CCA was correct about that, how is this evidence that there was a common scheme even relevant to the specification in charge 7 that's being charged? I mean, it seems like it's not really relevant. It maybe shouldn't have been admitted, but if that's true, how is it prejudicial? What did they gain from saying it was a common scheme that was prejudicial to your client?
I think the answer to that question lies squarely within the government's closing argument, because this is what they hammered on, that there were the buzzword that the trial counsel used was commonalities. And whether you believe that that is the same as a plan or a scheme, we believe it is a subterfuge for propensity.
But wasn't the issue with the seventh charge, the specification of the seventh charge, wasn't the issue really consent or mistake of fact as to consent? I mean, I just don't see how the previous I mean, maybe there was no scheme, but even if there was a scheme, how that would be relevant at all to that particular issue.
And Judge, so I make clear, you're talking about Specification 7. The specifications have all been renumbered. I think we're talking about specification was now Specification 5.
Yes.
Or maybe there's 4 and 5 were with the one victim, the one alleged victim. Like, am I tracking you correctly?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So, Judge, again, I can go back to the fact that the government's argument was, I mean, they moved specifically to move this evidence in. And going back to Judge Sparks' question, the question wasn't one of admissibility. The question was one of use, as you are saying. And so what we have done is we've given the military judge, and Who Kills says that this is the same whether it's a judge alone or a panel case, we have given the military judge the authority to do exactly what the government asked him to do here, which is, and I use the specification of charge one, specification one, rather, of the charge, where the appellant was acquitted, as the prime example of this, where the military judge could very well have said, okay, I don't find beyond a reasonable doubt that he did this, but I do find beyond a reasonable doubt that he has a common plan or scheme to go out with his friends, to drink alcohol with his friends, and for there to be sexual contact with his friends, which would lower the burden of proof on specifications 4 and 5, which is the one that you're addressing. So the prejudice is that it enabled the military judge to do exactly what the government asked him to do here, which is to say he has a common plan or scheme to drink with his friends and take and have sexual contact with them. And at that point, the issue of whether or not you're dealing with the first three specifications in which the alleged victims were awake as opposed to specification 4 and 5 is, in our opinion, a distinction without a difference.
Mr. Cacera, this was a military judge alone case. Now, my question is this. Your concern is that it concerns the burden of proof, right, being lowered. But doesn't a military judge know that he's not supposed to lower the burden of proof, notwithstanding what evidence he gets? Aren't we supposed to presume that he knows that that's not something he can do? So would that there'd be less of a danger of that than in a member's case, wouldn't you say?
I don't believe so, Judge. I think Who Kills is perfect evidence of that. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, the military judge is presumed to know the law. Yes, the military judge is presumed to do what he said he was going to do. And what he said he was going to do was to use 404B for a common plan or scheme.
But, A, the problem in Huckel is that what he assumed that the law was exactly wrong. Right? I mean, that was part of the problem in Huckel, is that we couldn't presume that he knew and applied the law because the law that he applied was incorrect based on Hills.
And I believe the law he applied in this case is incorrect, that 404B can be used for charged offenses within the same case.
But the problem is, or maybe it's not a problem, right, which is 413 specifically allows them to say that they can use it for propensity, right? 404B specifically says that they can't use it for that reason. They can use it for these other reasons.
And again, George, I'll go back to the same question with the same issue, which is in this particular case, the common plan or scheme was nothing more than propensity. So
I understand your argument.
Thank you. So, in erring that the military judge, that the military judge erred in finding a common plan or scheme, we now move to the issue of harmlessness, and I'll go addressing Judge Meg's questions. The error was constitutional in nature, so the erroneous admission of evidence is tested under the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard under Hills. In Hills, this court said that 413 errors involving charged conduct are constitutional because it is antithetical to the presumption of innocence to suggest that conduct of which an accused is presumed innocent may be used to show propensity to have committed other conduct of which he is presumed innocent. In this case, evidence of conduct for which the accused is presumed innocent was used to show that he had a common plan or scheme for other charges for which he is presumed innocent. And again, I go back to the same question, Judge Ryan, which is, in our opinion, the appellant's position is it's two sides of the same coin. Propensity evidence involving charged conduct gets the constitutional error analysis because there are two different burdens of proof for the same evidence, preponderance and then guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. A constitutional error under Hills requires reversal unless the government can prove that there was no reasonable probability that the error contributed to the verdict, and that is a Chapman test.
Mr. Cacera, yes. Can I go back to my double scenario, number one and number two that I mentioned earlier. Now, let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that we disagree with you that simply admitting or using 404B evidence raises the error. Let's assume for the moment that suppose we find that the evidence was simply improperly admitted as 404B evidence on 4 or 5 or both. Does the situation become a Hills issue at that point? Because if it's not properly admitted as 404B evidence on a plan, common scheme, whatever you want to call it, then is your position at that point that it can only have been used as propensity evidence? In other words, if it's not 404B on any of the categories allowed, then it can only have morphed or become propensity evidence. And then is that how you then get to the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard for prejudice?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because Haro case, I mean, the 404B cases are normally analyzed under the Haro standard. Now, we believe that if this court were to use the Haro standard, the appellant still prevails. But because of exactly what Judge Sparks just said, which is the lowering of the burden of proof that we have argued, then the 404B issue has now become a Hills Who Kills 413 analysis, and the proper standard is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I see that my time is up, subject to any questions, further questions from the members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Suki. Good morning, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Major Mike Bunnell. Ms. Mary Ellen Payne and I represent the United States today. The Air Force Court erred when it found that the 404B evidence was not logically relevant. But if the evidence was wrongly admitted, then appellant wasn't prejudiced. I want to start with the certified issue if I can, because the Air Force Court made something of a counterintuitive ruling in my estimation. They decided this case not on a 403 balancing analysis, but they said that specifications 1 through 3 are not even logically connected to the issues going on in specifications 4 and 5. And that is the holding that we take issue with. We think there are three rather large problems with it. The first is, the most glaring, is that it ignores the threshold test in Reynolds, meaning it never asks the question, what is the issue in controversy in this case? Second, it conflates the difference in tactic with a difference in plan. And finally, the Air Force Court just did not give the military judge sufficient deference as afforded by the law. Now, on this first issue of whether or not the issue is in controversy, I think you can boil the entire case down to the question, how similar do these actually have to be? And the answer to that question is and always has been the same. That is, it depends. What is the issue in controversy? What is the defense? If the defense is, I was never in that room with Airman J.D., you've got the wrong guy, then the requirement for similarity is much higher. If the defense is, I didn't realize I was doing anything wrong, then the requirement for similarity is much lower. And that's what we get from Reynolds. It specifically says, as it addresses logical relevancy, the question of whether particular acts are admissible turns upon the issue in controversy. And interestingly, I think Reynolds relies on a treatise by Professor Wigmore kind of throughout the entire opinion. And not just Reynolds, Brannon and the Second Circuit and Danzy, the Fifth Circuit and Beecham, Radsek, Reese, and the Seventh Circuit. It seems everybody relies on this treatise because it's very helpful. What Professor Wigmore says is, look, there's two buckets. There's mens rea, similar acts used to show mens rea, and there's similar acts used to show the actus reus. Those are treated differently. And I want to just read briefly what he had to say about how it's treated for mens rea. He said, the charged act is assumed as done, and the mind only asks for something that will negate innocent intent. And the mere occurrence of an act similar in its gross features, the same doer, the same sort of act, but not necessarily the same mode of acting, may suffice for that purpose. This standard is what Reynolds is describing when it says you have to be significantly similar, similar in significant ways, not in minor, irrelevant ways. And that's what we have in this case. So that's where the Air Force Court got off on the wrong foot, is they said common planner scheme always goes to the actus reus, and they cited United States versus Morrison, but in that case the controversy was very different. So that's our first argument, is the standard is up here. for actus reus, but the standard is here for mens rea, and that was the issue in controversy. Our second argument is simply, even if it was up here, even if we had to show...
But in that regard, how did, and for ease of discussion, I'm going to refer to 1, 2, 3, and then 4, 5. With 4, 5, those two offenses, we're talking about the issue about whether there was consent or a reasonable mistake of fact in regard to consent. Consent was not an issue with 1, 2, and 3, correct?
Correct.
So why is there, in your scale, when you're talking about being the top of the scale and accused saying I wasn't even present, why are you saying that this is way down the scale in terms of it demonstrating mens rea?
Because we looked at the charged conduct. It's the issue in controversy for the charged conduct. And so the issue in controversy is we're trying to show whether he had a plan in his mind when he went into the room where he knew his drunk, unsuspecting, platonic friend had been asleep for over an hour.
But wasn't, in terms of 1, 2, 3, he did it secretly, or should I say furtively, and he retreated immediately and so forth. With 4 and 5, it was more of a persuasive attempt on his part. So where are the similarities there that you identify?
Because that's a very important question, because I want to be clear. The distinction is marked. He talks to JD before he touches him, but he doesn't. There's no evidence of him talking to the other three. Here's the distinction. We're getting caught up on a tactic versus a strategy. His plan is always the same. When he's downstairs and he knows that his drunk, unsuspecting friend is upstairs, that's when we're looking. When he went upstairs, what was his intent? What was his plan? Was it the same thing that he had been doing before? The fact that he opened the door and JD woke up, it means he had to adjust fire a little bit, but that doesn't change his overall plan. And you can see that really clearly in Reynolds. So in Reynolds, the facts are much more disparate than we have now. So the similar fact is that he showed him a slideshow. This was the Top Gun case. So in that case, both girls, he showed him a slideshow. But one girl just left right afterward. He picked her up in his silver Porsche, and he raped her in the woods. Where the other girl, who was there after the slideshow, he just forced himself on her. That's a dramatic change in tactic. But the underlying strategy, the plan itself, is exactly the same. I'm going to read the plan from Reynolds because it's directly applicable.
But in terms of identical strategy or same strategy, with the first three victims, when they realized that he was sexually assaulting them, he didn't then proceed to engage in the same type of conversation that he did in 4 and 5 with Senior Airman J.D. He could have said to those other men, have you ever thought about experimenting with men sexually and so forth? So in terms of looking at it through that mindset, how similar are these really?
I think the only specification that even allows for that type of possibility is Specification 3. This is the one where he's reaching over the couch. So in Specification 1, once the guy realizes what's going on, he just chases him out of the room. So there's really not an option for a conversation about it because he was met with different resistance from that victim. Specification 2, he was asleep the entire time. He didn't know what happened until the morning. And Specification 3 is when he's reaching over the couch, and that's really the indicative one. I think it goes to your point, is he reaches over the couch, swats his hand away, and then he tries again. And it's clear that he's trying to see what he can get away with, and the same thing is happening here. Granted, it's a little bit different in that he's using words. The underlying strategy is exactly like Reynolds. Let me just read this from Reynolds because it's spot on. It says, he worked out a system to put his victim into an unsuspecting and vulnerable position whereby he could engage in sexual intercourse with or without consent. That's what's going on, is when he was downstairs at the party and he was going to go up to the room, he knew this individual is in a place where I don't have to ask for a freely given agreement in the same way. I think it might even be helpful to look at it. Here would be an actual change in plan. Let's say that Airman J.D. is downstairs during the party playing, and he says, I'm done with this party. I want to go play a video game in your room. Is that okay? And the appellant says, go right ahead. And then he goes up there about an hour later, and there's J.D. playing a video game, and he comes to him and says, hey, have you ever thought about having sex with a guy before? And J.D. says, no, I'm not interested. And then he starts to touch him. That would be very different because he has his faculties about him. There's no question of whether or not he can have his way with him. He's going to have to get a freely given agreement. at that point. So his strategy would have been different when he went into that room. But that's not what's going on here. But from the appellant's point of view, when he enters that room, it's the exact same scenario as when it is for the other three.
I'm a little bit confused about what happened in this case. So let me just, if you don't mind, ask you a couple questions. This was a judge alone trial, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So all the evidence that was admitted was based on the charges on the charge sheet?
Correct. It's all charged conduct.
So the 404B motion was ruled upon in order to justify denying the motion for severance?
Well, it was all tied up in the same idea. That it is convoluted, right?
So I mean, it wasn't. Was the evidence actually admitted as 404B evidence?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely it was. And it's on page 703, I believe, of the joint appendix when he actually goes through the Reynolds analysis and says that, yeah, it's probative for this purpose to show that he had a plan, a common plan, to take advantage of his unsuspecting drunk friends.
So if it had not been admitted as 404B evidence, could the government have still made that argument?
If the judge had
if he hadn't admitted his 404B evidence, you're in a judge alone trial, all these charges on the charge sheet, could the government have argued, this wasn't a mistake, this is what he does?
Well, I think it's not necessarily this is what he does, but this was the plan that was in his mind. But I think it depends. I mean, does defense counsel object to it? So they're just in there presenting and saying, look, we can see that there's enough commonalities that we know that he had a plan in his mind when he went into JD. And there's no objection? Is that the scenario?
Well, let's say there is an objection.
Well, if there's an objection, then the military judge has got to go through the Reynolds analysis just as he would in any other situation. I guess I'm misunderstanding the question.
I guess my point is these charges are on the charge sheet, right?
Correct.
And so the question is, but for the fact that it was admitted as 404B evidence, can the government argue over objection, right, that, you know, we know from the fact that he did X, Y, and Z that this was no mistake? This is a plan he had.
Well, I think that's exactly what this court got at in Cox. So if you remember that case, it was a child case, multiple children, and the members are deliberating, and they come back on the record, and they say, look, we've got a question. We think that there's lustful intent for specification one, but can we use that to infer lustful intent in here? And this court said emphatically, yes, exclamation point. That's what 404B evidence is. Now, they didn't raise it at trial, but it's admissible for that purpose. So as long as it's being used for an appropriate 404B purpose.
But the problem, I think we're crossing paths here, right, which is this evidence was coming in, whether it was admitted as 404B evidence or not.
Correct. Coming in. No question about it.
So then why did it have to be admitted as 404B evidence?
Well, I don't know if it had to, but the whole point was the defense counsel raised a motion saying it doesn't qualify as 404B evidence. It needs to be excluded, and that was the point of the severance motion. That was one of the issues, I guess, in this. The severance motion is a bit of a mess. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a 413 severance and 404B in the same analysis. Are we? With respect to prejudice, if there's no other questions on maybe the substantive certified issue. I do want to talk really quickly about abuse of discretion and the standard itself. And so when we look at the precedent that's on the books, we've got, you know, Reynolds, we've got Munoz, Johnson, Simpson. When the military and the judge specifically looked at each one of those cases, when you look at those on the books, the level of similarity between those cases and the charged acts and the level of similarity, the heightened similarity that we have in this case is marked. And so when we're looking at it through the lens of, was it really arbitrary or fanciful? Was it just completely unreasonable to apply these laws to these facts? And I think that the answer is no. I mean, that we're giving ultimate deference. The military judge put his 403 balancing test on the record. It was very robust. And so to come to the conclusion that it's just arbitrary for the military judge to do that, given this precedent that's already on the books, is not tenable.
So why doesn't Hills and Hugel change the landscape when it comes to the standard of review?
Well, I think to Judge Ryan's point, the issue is propensity. Propensity is what erodes the presumption of innocence. So if the argument is, look, I'm going to take specification one by a preponderance of the evidence and determine he's a bad guy, he's not an innocent guy, And then I'm going to use that to infer that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt for all these other specifications. There's a presumption of the innocence, of innocence problem. But if propensity is not allowed, then it doesn't create the same problem. And I think that this Court preempted that argument in footnote 4 of Hills, where it said this doesn't apply to 404B evidence.
Now, counsel, so you would agree with Mr. Casera's argument, though, that if we were to conclude that this evidence was improperly admitted under 404B because it's actually propensity evidence because there was no plan or scheme. Now, you disagree with that, but if we disagreed with you and concluded that, then we would have to determine, just like in Hills, that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
If you conclude there's propensity evidence, then it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Yeah, that's propensity evidence. I agree.
Is it a binary choice? Is it either proper 404B evidence or propensity evidence?
No, there's an option that it's irrelevant evidence. I mean, I think that's where AFCA or the Air Force Court arrived, is they said, and this is kind of an interesting point, right? They realized that mistake and consent are the only issues in prejudice, and they say, well, it really didn't have anything to say about mistake or consent, but they didn't realize it during the substantive issue of 404B. And so essentially the argument I'm trying to make here is you can't have your cake and eat it too. Either it was probing into something or it wasn't, but not both. If it was negating his mens rea, then it was probative and it should have come in. If it was not negating his mens rea, then it was irrelevant and it couldn't have been prejudicial. And so that's...
I don't quite understand that argument. Why, with propensity evidence, essentially saying this is a bad person who does this. So that's very damning evidence that comes in that context, isn't it?
Well, the premise of what I just said is that it's not propensity evidence. And so if it was propensity evidence, it's a different analysis. Okay. But assuming it's not propensity evidence, and frankly, when you look at the case, this particular case is interesting because the military judge not only is presumed to know that he can't use it for a propensity purpose, he did. I mean, he went through great lengths to explain. In fact, he stopped trial counsel in the middle of the severance motion and said, trial counsel, you're saying if you separate these, that you're going to use it as 413 because it definitely works as propensity. But if we keep it together, you're going to use it as 404B. Don't you see the problem, trial counsel? I mean, so there's no question about the military judge understanding the propensity ban, and the only argument left is that he did it anyway, which amounts to a bad faith allegation. There's just no evidence of that. And so propensity is really a red herring in this case, but when we're looking at prejudice, we're just looking at the Harrow factors. And that materiality one, I think, is incredibly important because it is either material and probative or it was not material and improbative. It was not prejudicial. But if we're just looking, for example, at the strength of the government's case, the government, Senior Airman J.D., was a very compelling witness. His testimony was uncontradicted. It was corroborated. In fact, defense counsel relied on the facts as Airman J.D. told them in all of his arguments. The defense's case was incredibly weak in comparison. In fact, they went through and they split hairs. When they got to Specification 4, for example, their defense was, no, man, I just want to go to sleep, actually is keep going and maybe I'll change my mind. I mean, that's a weak argument, and that's all that they had. They didn't put on any evidence, no witnesses. And so measuring those two together, it's really just not a compelling case for the defense. Barring any other questions, if I could briefly conclude.
I have one question. Getting back to Judge Maggs's sort of hypothetical, and I'm not asking you to concede anything, nor am I in any way forecasting what this court might do. But let's assume for the moment that, kind of along the lines of what I discussed with Mr. Casera during his presentation, which is, let's assume for the moment that the court finds that it was improperly admitted 404B evidence. Mr. Casera's position is that if that's the case, it could only have been used as propensity evidence. And if that's the case, we are in the world of Huckel and Hills, and therefore we're using the constitutional standard. Let's assume we've moved that far. What would be the government's argument to demonstrate prejudice, assuming you think you have the burden at that point?
So let me just make sure I'm understanding the hypothetical. It is propensity evidence that is used for a propensity.
Well, let me ask you, do you agree that if it's improperly improperly used as 404B evidence on plan, intent, whatever else, then it could only then, it transforms or morphs, for lack of a better word, into propensity use. It can only be used as propensity evidence. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I think okay. This is kind of what Judge Ryan was getting at. Is it one or the other? And the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can use it or try to admit it for something like plan. And like in Brannon, where they tried to admit it as a plan, that was the admission, the theory at trial. But on appeal, they admitted it, that this court determined on a completely separate issue that wasn't brought up at trial, that it's good for intent, that that's okay mm-hmm. for intent, and so there was no prejudice.
Okay, what if what I'm saying is that what if it doesn't fit any of the categories under 404B?
Then it's a problem. Then it's propensity.
Yeah, and I'm saying what if, in my hypothetical, what if we've reached that point, and now we're trying to determine whether or not the use by the military judge of this evidence on specifications 4 and 5 was prejudicial or not. Aren't we then in the world of Hukel?
Yeah, I think if you can rule out any yeah. possible 404B and
sure.
it has to be propensity, then yeah, I think that.
Okay, and then I'm assuming it was that at that point, then what would the government's argument be on prejudice?
Well, not as good as the short answer. So that's a
much. I'm not making an assessment one way or the other. I'm just asking.
So I guess this goes back to my earlier question where I said, is it a binary choice between it's either proper 404B evidence or if it's not, it's there for propensity? And you said, no, it's not binary. And now it seems like you're saying that it is. And my question is, couldn't it simply be it wasn't 404B because it wasn't relevant, because it didn't really do anything, because it didn't show what they thought that it would show? Does that necessarily mean it's propensity evidence?
Again, it all comes back to what's the issue in controversy. I think you're right. So it could be irrelevant. And again, the whole point of a plan or scheme is to show the actus reus, which was already given in this case. And so it really can't add a lot to the equation when they're admitting that the acts happened. And so it's not really plugging any of the gaps in that regard. Good, Joanna. I've got 25 seconds. I haven't answered your question well.
I know you have. I'm confused. Nothing you did.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
It's always your fault.
It's always my fault.
You know I'm teasing.
You've been talking to my wife, I can tell. Judge Ryan, I would like to pick up with one of the questions that you asked very early on, which is whether or not, if this is not 404B evidence, could the government have used it in argument? The appellant's position is no, because that violates the spillover instruction. You would have been asking the military judge to do exactly what the spillover instruction says you can't do, because we are not applying, you know, and the typical instruction from a military judge is, yes, you can use evidence of a knife to argue that he stole a knife and that he stabbed somebody because you've recovered the knife. This is not the case in which that is.
What about Judge Ryan's other point that if it's not 404B use, then your position was if it's not 404B use, then it kind of automatically transforms to propensity, and her point that it could be simply irrelevant. What about that point?
Because it seems to me that your argument is if it's not proper 404B evidence, therefore the only reason that they could have admitted it or used it was for propensity, right? But we have a judge that's clearly said not using it for propensity, can't use it for propensity. So, but let's say he was wrong in saying it was scheme or plan. How does that necessarily translate to propensity evidence? I mean, because that's the sticky wicket.
Oh, I understand.
In your argument, as far as I'm concerned.
I understand. I'm trying. I think the two of you asked different questions, so I want to make sure I'm answering the right question.
Well, I was referring to her question.
Okay.
Which is only one question.
I didn't want to talk to one of you and not the other.
That's okay.
We're sitting right next to each other.
Yeah, we're
I can fake it. Well, Judge, so if I do want to make sure I understand your question correctly. Your question is, if this is not 404B, why does it automatically become propensity as opposed to why is it just irrelevant? Or why could it not just be irrelevant? Was that the question?
Why could it just not be? I mean, why is it necessarily propensity evidence if it wasn't used as propensity evidence? I mean, you seem to say it's binary. If it's not for a proper 404B, therefore it must be propensity evidence. And I'm asking you why.
Okay.
Why is that necessarily so, what the judge specifically said, not going to use it as propensity evidence?
Because the terms that the judge said that he was going to use it for are nearly, if not identically, synonymous with propensity. That's the issue in the case, if I can say it in probably just a few sentences or a few words. In other words, in this particular case, because of the way that the facts played out, and I thought Judge Meg's question, or Judge Olson, rather, whichever one, I'll turn this way then, as to, you know, you're talking about some specifications in which consent was the defense, and some specifications in which it just didn't happen or it was playing was the defense. And then you're talking about a common plan or scheme, as the trial counsel originally argued, or commonalities. The only commonality is that he is a guy that likes to have sexual contact with other guys. And that's propensity, no matter how the military judge tried to slice it.
But his defense was mistake of fact, right, as to consent?
On
five.
On four and five, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. But to overcome the lack of evidence of a lack of consent, and it's always somewhat confusing as we talk about those things, but to overcome the question of whether there was consent, what the trial counsel did and what the military judge allowed the trial counsel to do was to say the commonality of 1, 2, and 3 defeats the lack of consent argument of 4 and 5. And that's the problem in this case. Judge Dookie, did you have a question for me?
I did not.
I'm sorry, Judge. So the error was constitutional, so the erroneous admission of the evidence, again, is tested under the Hill standard. The acquittal in Specification 2 does not distinguish the harm that flowed from allowing that evidence. Contrary, this probably shocks many of you, but I disagree with my opposing counsel as to the strength of the defense case. I believe that the government's case was particularly weak. And the judge, I cannot pronounce her last name, I think it's Hugin, who wrote the dissent of the Air Force Court's opinion, very well lays out the weakness in the government's case as it relates to Specification 5. The evidence in Specifications 5.
Was she doing that as a factual sufficiency matter, right, for the most part?
She was, absolutely, absolutely. As you look at the evidence and specifications 4 and 5, there's this, hey, have you ever thought about fooling around with a guy? And the answer is, no, I just want to go to sleep. The government's argument at trial was that shows that he didn't consent. That does not go to consent at all. That goes to the question of whether or not he's ever thought about having sexual contact with a male. Members of the court, that concludes my time. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that concludes your term, and I will see you.
Sure. Thank you, counsel. It does indeed conclude the term. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and we invite all present to join us in the foyer at noon for an end-of-term reception. And in the meantime, you can sit around and argue cases or whatever you want to do.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Court is in recess pending further order of the court.